Mother's Day is almost here, and you can get her the most beautiful time-tested gift around. A watch she can wear every day for Movement. Whether mom's into classic dress watches, rare and refined ceramics, or tried-and-true bestsellers, Movement has something she'll love. And right now, you can save big on the best Mother's Day gift ever with up to 50% off site-wide during Movement's Mother's Day sale at MVMT.com. Again, that's up to 50% off at MVMT.com.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
If you want to come on and...
Howdy, folks. Welcome into Millennial Money, everybody. Andre Graham in the house and me, Jeremy. And we got a lot to talk about. Oil, stocks, crypto, housing, so much more. Andre Graham, take it away. How are you gentlemen doing tonight?
Good. How are you guys? How are you?
Muy bueno. Doing very well, except for this market, because it's a tough market out there. I don't know if you guys see it. I'm sure you're feeling it. It's a lot of pain out there, and we are in extreme fear. Extreme fear, gentlemen.
Where's the buy button? With the buy, I forget. Is it? Gosh, Jim Cramer. We need one on our own.
Is that what you guys think when you see a chart like this or something like this where it says extreme fear? Does in your mind just tell you now's the time to buy, or how do you guys
think? If I was somebody, you know, it's funny. I never timed the market, but I always mentally try to. Like, I'm like, if I could put in a ton of money right now, I feel like now would be a great time. So I've always played a mental game with myself, but I never actually act on it. So yeah, I feel like now is a great time to buy. But
so far, yeah, if you look back at the S&P objectively throughout the last year, we're basically at the same level we were a year ago. So it's like being able to buy last year's prices today. Yeah. When you look at it like that, I mean, it does make you seem like, you know, you might be getting a deal, well, at least compared to where we were, I don't know, 6 months ago, 5 months ago.
Yeah, it's incredible. Oh, Alex, if you want to take us to the next slide, you can see basically how this has transpired over the past 3 years. It's extraordinary. I don't know if you want to take us to the next one, Alex, but essentially what you're going to see is we're in the most fearful market we have been since March of 2020, which is pretty extraordinary. And I mean, think about, like, what do you guys think was a more fearful market to you? March of 2020 or right now?
March. By far.
Yeah, but we have fearful versus valuations. I mean, yes, you could say that even back then the values were high, but we've come from such a peak. And now that I think it's sinking in that, wait a second, maybe inflation's going to be higher. The ban on oil is maybe driving prices higher. Is that going to mean interest rates are going to rise faster? What's that going to do to the value of our assets? That mean things are going to decline. So that's where I think the fear is based now. Versus the uncertainty of, you know, what might happen during during a shutdown.
Yeah, Jeremy, how do they remind us, please? How do they measure this kind of fear? How is it like? How are they getting that index?
Yeah, they're taking a bunch of different stuff into account. There's like seven core metrics they use for this. Essentially, one is the VIX, which is like the volatility index, and you know, the VIX has spiked to, for people for reference, 37 as of the other day, or actually today it hit 37, which is extremely high. And whenever the VIX spikes that high, usually people are doing some stuff. They're selling stocks. It looks at the junk bond market. It looks at the bond market, and it looks at some other various factors, and it takes all that into account into like this algorithm, which pumps you out a number of what you're in.
No, the VIX, I remember anything above 30 or 32, wasn't it? That was considered extreme fear. And then anything, where's the average at usually in the market? Is it like 20, to 25, somewhere around like that.
Yeah, Alex, if you want to take us a couple slides ahead here, I'll show you essentially. Yeah, that was a fear and greed, by the way, over the past 3 years. So that's interesting. Yeah. So as you see there, March of 2020 is the only time in the past 3 years we've had this fearful of a market, which is crazy. So yeah, if you want to take us the next one there, Alex, that one's going to show the VIX. And oh no, wait, this one shows PayPal. I'm sorry, Alex, I didn't give you the VIX. I apologize. I messed up. Anyways, so the VIX is at a 37 here today. Yes, Andre, if you're over 30, you're really, really high. If you're over 35, you're insanely high. And when it comes to VIX, there's very few times it goes that high. And I was looking at like the past 20 years, and there's only maybe 20 or 30 times in the past 20 years where the VIX has spiked over 35. And usually how it works is every single time, shortly after, within a couple months of that, you go on another massive bull run most of the time.
Yeah. Now, what's interesting, when you look at the VIX, the last time it surpassed 35, now it did get very close, January 29th at 33. But the time before that was October 30th, spiked to 38.
I'm just surprised at the greed of 2020 or 2019. I'm not sure where that falls, but the peak, almost 100.
Yeah, a lot of people were pretty bullish going into 2020. And it was, you know, 2020 was setting up like it was going to be a strong year for earnings and a strong year for companies, obviously. And then all of a sudden, out of nowhere, we were hit with a once in a hundred year pandemic. And that greed slowly went into mass fear. And, you know, there was a 35% fall in 22 trading days in the S&P 500, which is, you know, the fastest fall in the history of the S&P 500 for context. And then you look back at obviously going into 2021, man, we are in a greedy market. And then boy, has that fallen rapidly. My gosh. I mean, if you were to overlay, it would have been fun to overlay like the NASDAQ. You would probably see that the NASDAQ kind of follows a similar line, or the Russell 2000 or something like that. Mm-hmm. So yeah, we're in a fearful market, and that's for dang sure. You know, and the question is, you know, do you guys see the fear ending anytime soon? Or do you feel like we're going to have this fear for weeks or months to go in the future? What do you guys foresee there?
I think it's always
thinking about this.
You go first, Andre.
Okay. So I was thinking about this too. So the way I look at it is this highly depends on the conflict, right, in Europe. It seems like everything is hinged on that. And then I was thinking, wars kind of don't end, right? Like, I don't remember the last time that someone was like, okay, this is over now. We've declared victory. They just kind of drag on for years and years, and then they fizzle out. And that's my fear, is like the last thing I would want is for, you know, the Ukraine-Russia thing to play out over years. I'm hoping it ends soon, but like, what does that mean, end? Like, one side gives up to the other. I guess Russia pulls out. I don't know. I don't see like a definitive end to that. So I don't know. Maybe that's the pessimist in me, but well, what do you think, Graham?
Well, I think this is somewhat similar. Well, you could look at COVID too, the same sort of thing. It's not technically, it's not over,
right?
But the effects have somewhat diminished. And when you look at it that way, it's almost like things will somewhat fade, but then something else will take its place. And at least for the last 2 years, it's always been something else on the horizon. And that then takes the focus. And in this case, I think, you know, after Russia, Ukraine, I think it's going to be interest rates. And then if it's not interest rates on March 16th, it's going to be interest rates on the next tightening cycle and the next one. And then potentially there might be something else in between. So I think there's always going to be something else that's out there that will drag attention away. There's always going to be a reason to be fearful.
Exactly. The market kind of goes in these patterns where 1 minute it's fearful over this. Like at first it was inflation, right? It's like inflation's going crazy. The market got fearful over that. Then it was, the Fed's going to raise rates like 8-9 times. And then the market got scared over that. Then it was Russia, Ukraine took the situation. And now recently it's oil prices going sky high. So it seems like the market's going to look at whatever it really wants to look at. And it's only going to care about that for so long. Even if you think about Rona, I mean, it really cared about it for about 2 or 3 months. And then we just kind of moved past it, right? And the market just started moving up and, you know, off to the moon we were. So yeah, it's fun to kind of see how long these things last and how long the market actually cares about it. So, you know.
Well, speaking of the oil stuff, did you guys see the chart that showed kind of like the oil, how oil's kind of not necessarily predicted recessions, but sort of preceded them
I
right
did.
Around the time they hit the all-time high? I don't know if Alex, if you want to pull up that information.
Yeah, that I thought was a very interesting chart. It was going around on Twitter. That's where I saw it.
Yeah.
Ooh. So, because I mean, obviously, 08, oil went really high. But I mean, can we really blame? I think it was March of 08, actually, oil hit like record, like 140, 150 or something. But can we really blame that recession on gas prices going up and oil going up? You know, there's so many various things that were at play in that, with the housing crisis and companies and the financial crisis.
Yeah, I don't know if it, I don't think it was oil that, I think oil was more of like a symptom. Like when you have a fever, most likely you have this. Mm. And it's somewhat similar. It's like when you have high oil prices or energy prices, then most likely you will have this as a result. No, that's not it.
But that does show how insane oil has gone recently, which I think is interesting just for people that don't really keep up with this. I mean, it's a pretty darn epic run, you know, from 60-ish a barrel to 100 plus. Brent's been trading over 130 recently, which is more important for the European market. And the worst part is we don't know when, you know, how long that's going to go for.
Do you guys remember when oil went negative?
I remember that.
We did a video about that.
$30 a barrel or something like that. Just to haul it away. They had too much of it.
The infinite money glitch with oil. That was fun.
Guys, what we should have done, we should have just bought warehouses in Vegas and then just taken all that oil, got the money, stored it, and then now we could be selling it and be so rich. Oh, my gosh. Yeah.
No, I think the issue was that in order to store the oil, I think it was a price like $200,000 a day.
Right.
For the tanker to store it.
Yeah, so you would need to buy a lot of oil to make that worth it.
That's right. The oil futures market in 2020. I remember that.
Yeah. But it was also, I believe, it was just the Texas crude that was trading negative because they had excess that they couldn't get rid of. Here we go. Here's the chart. So every time oil has exceeded $104, there's been a recession. But funny enough, not funny enough, you could see during the 2020 quick recession, how it dipped. It never really exceeded that. So the recession wasn't so much because of oil, but that was such a minor.
This is kind of terrifying, though. Look at this graph. Literally every single peak that exceeds that 50 mark or $104, every single time it's been in that zone of a recession, except for 2000. Is it 2000 around there? They don't quite line up perfectly. But every other time,
right?
It lines up.
You know what's interesting about this, though, guys? Think about this for a moment. Oil at, let's say, 104 or whatever, back in the 70s, 80s, even if we go back to 2008, was a lot more money than it is today, right? Imagine you're paying, you know, $4 a gallon in 2008. That's not worth nearly as much nowadays if you're paying $4 a gallon, right? So I think that's just another way to think about it. It seems like in order to get the same effect, you would almost need to see maybe oil at 150 or something like that.
But if that was the case, Jeremy, then why are we seeing the same correlation from, say, 1990, 2010, all the way back to 1970? You would have figured that peak would be lower and lower, you know, decades ago by that logic. But it's still somehow magically that $104 mark. It doesn't make sense.
That's a good point. Yeah, that's wild. And man, it reminds me of the yield curve. When the yield curve inverts, they say, oh, recession's going to come within, I think it's like 6 to 18 months or something like that. So we'll see.
I always think that these are true until they're not. And, you know, like it'll happen, but then it won't happen. And then they could rationalize that by saying, well, when you account for inflation, then actually now it's $200 a barrel. So I feel like there's always going to be something because, yeah, I mean, oil at $100 a barrel, let's just say, in 1990 is significantly more expensive than it is at $100 today. Right. So I know it seems like they're all adding up and, you know, very well maybe they are. But I'm always skeptical when a chart always has something always happens every single time after this. I'm always skeptical that it's like, oh, well, there's the one time it doesn't.
Yeah, there's always a caveat. But Jeremy, with what you were saying with the inverted yield curve, I'm seeing this in the media a lot where the yield curve is flattening, right? And then if it ever, you know, goes negative, then, like you said, 6 to 18 months, there's a recession. But what they don't say is that it's not one of those things where if it dips, Like it has to last there for a while. It can't just like dip below that point and come back up. And then it's like, oh, we're going to get a recession. It has to sustain for quite a while. So for example, the way this relates here is, you know, the conflict with Europe. If we get the inverted yield curve to happen and it comes back up as a result of the conflict, it doesn't mean we're guaranteed the recession in 6 to 18 months, because it has to have a sustaining effect for a while for the recession to actually happen, based on my understanding. I could be wrong, but that's the way I kind of understand it.
That makes sense. And then a question, do you guys know the last time the yield curve inverted? Was it 2019?
Yeah, I believe it was late 2019. And it just so happened to have the shutdown right afterwards. Yeah.
Exactly.
We don't know if that would have led to something had it not been for that. Yeah. Maybe.
Mm-hmm. I know. You know,
I wanted to make a video that was called "The Recession That Was Supposed to Happen," or "The Recession That Never Happened," and talk about exactly that, how we had the inverted yield curve, and it almost seems like it got postponed. So imagine if the shutdown only postponed what was supposed to happen, and now we're seeing fears of it again, and it's just like, I don't know.
It's a possibility, but I mean, I remember going into 2020, it was going to be a pretty bullish year for stocks. There were a lot of reasons that companies' earnings were going to increase quite a bit. Revenue was going to be up. I you know, we can never replay it, but I think 2020 was going to be a pretty good year. It was going to shape up to be a really good year. And that's why stocks, you know, people were feeling pretty darn good about the market going into 2020, including myself. But then you get that once in 100-year event that comes out of nowhere and it messes us up, man. Messes us up. Yeah. Now everybody has to pay $1 million more for a house. It's out of control. So, all right, Alex, you want to take us over to the next slide here? I want to get these gentlemen's opinions on this next stock, and if you guys are buying a dip in this one.
Uh-oh.
And it's one we all know very well, this company. You know,
Tattoo Chef.
Yeah. Could you imagine? I'll try to sell you guys on that every day.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So PayPal, 60% plus the stock has fallen in the past 14 months, 50% plus in the past 4 months. You know, incredible fall for the stock. I mean, they own PayPal, Venmo. Their business is tearing up. Cash flow machine, profit machine, revenue is going the right way. Customers going the right way. But the market just, you know, it's not like the PayPal's only stock down in this market. I mean, there's so many stocks down 50, 60, 70% that I don't even know where to start. But you know, this is one of those that I feel like, even if you're kind of a beginner in the market, right? This is kind of an easy one, I feel like, to get your head around and be like, hey, you know, if I'm going to pick an individual stock, maybe a PayPal, something like that. It kind of reminds me of like, you know, Apple or Facebook or Microsoft or one of those type of companies. So, you know, is this one that interests you guys at all or not really?
When I see charts like this, I'm always thinking like, how come the analysts that make fun of Bitcoin don't show me charts like this when they're like, Bitcoin's so volatile. Look how much it loses. 60%, man, for a stock like that. I don't recall the last time Bitcoin did a move like that. I mean, that's pretty substantial.
Yeah, well, that's a great point. I mean, it's been a pretty fast fall. I mean, to be fair though, Bitcoin did hit about 69,000. Not to say Bitcoin is, you know, worse or better, but Bitcoin did hit about 69,000, then it fell to what, 30, 31, or 33 or whatever.
True.
But yeah,
it doesn't happen faster. So, do you think the reason that PayPal is falling partially is because the sanctions in Russia, since Russian customers can't use it there anymore? Why is it such a risk on, like, why is it perceived like such a risk on asset that it's falling so far?
It seems like they initially got hit with a new IRS rule that wanted them to track business payments. So all of a sudden they had to track,
right?
Yeah. Well, yeah, it was anything over $600 that was marked as a business transaction. So then they had to ask you, are you paying for goods and services? And if you check yes, then they issue a statement to the IRS. So I think a lot of people initially got freaked out over that. So that, I think, was their kind of initial hit. Same with Venmo. I mean, they all got kind of hit with that at the same time. Then you combine that they're somewhat of a tech company. Well, they are a tech company that is also impacted by rising rates. I still like them. But then I also got to be vigilant not to, because I do own some individual stocks, and PayPal is one of them that I started buying. I think it was like 110 or something like that. And then I've been slowly averaging in a little bit lower. But they're one of the stocks where I don't want to go in too heavy with them, because then I made a horrible mistake with C3 AI, thinking, oh, I'm just going to buy the dip and it just keep dipping. So, you know, I just make sure with any individual stock, it doesn't account for more than like a few percent of the overall portfolio. And once it hits a few percent, I just cut myself off. And then anytime I get an urge to buy more, I'm like, well, buy more S&P. So I've been buying a little bit of PayPal, but arguably not much. I do like them though. I try to buy companies that I do use on a daily basis, and PayPal is one of them.
To be honest, I don't know. Do you guys like, okay, so Graham uses it. I don't hardly use PayPal. I don't really use it at all.
You use Venmo?
I use Venmo a lot, I guess, but not really PayPal.
Yeah.
Okay. Not really
PayPal. But that's owned by PayPal. So it's like, you know,
true,
do you use
it's
it?
A small portion of it, isn't it?
It's growing fast. That's their faster growing business. And it kind of reminds me of Facebook, right? If you're thinking about buying Facebook stock, people are like, well, I don't use Facebook, so I'm not going to consider Facebook stock. And it's like, do you use Instagram?
Yeah.
And they're like, yeah, every
I
minute.
I love Instagram. Instagram's the best.
Yeah. Like, well, they own that, right? WhatsApp, Oculus. So, but yeah, with PayPal, it's definitely one of those stocks that I think it's a good beginner stock in the market. Like if you're thinking about, you want to go down the rabbit hole of actually buying individual stocks, which isn't for everybody, but the folks that do, I think you've got to throw PayPal in there. You got to throw companies like Meta, Google, Apple, Amazon, those sorts of stocks. And it's nice when you can get them at, I mean, this is at a multi-year low when you look at that stock chart. You know, it's getting down to prices it was back in 2018, 2019, which is just crazy. So, it's one of many stocks that just has made an incredible move. But Alex, if you want to take us to the next slide. I thought this was interesting, gentlemen. I would love to hear your opinion on this because I think, you know, obviously we live in the States and we always hear about income equality and housing prices going up. And I saw this and I was just like, this is interesting. It seems like it's more than just the United States, South Korea to elect new leader to tackle soaring house prices and inequality. So, you know, isn't it incredible that this is like a worldwide phenomenon? And like, why do you think there's such kind of wealth inequality? You know, like, why is this going on? Is it because of innovation? Is it because you can do so much more with less employees in the past? Is it because the people that have money have more money and know how to invest it better? Like, what's your guys' perspective on this?
First of all, I'm curious, how are they planning to tackle soaring housing prices and inequality?
Jeremy. You just asked like a doctorate level question. You're like, guys, like economics, like solve it for me. What's going on?
Yeah. solve it in this live stream here. 5 minutes. Next 5 minutes to solve it.
Like, bro, I don't know.
All right. I know somebody that can give me an answer to this. Kevin, answer.
First, we have to make a video like trashing him and then get him to come on.
Oh gosh. I mean, okay, so if we're going to talk about housing prices, I mean, let's say we had to tackle the housing prices of Las Vegas, right? I think the first place we would think is we got to build more. I think first off, right? Let's open up more land. Let's get more builders building as quickly as possible. I think that's probably our first place we'd go to. I think wealth inequality is a really tough subject. And that's one I've spent some time thinking about. And it's like, sure, you could tax people and, you know, the whole tax the rich movement and put taxes at 70% or whatever. But that's a tough thing because a lot of these corporations and companies and businesses are just getting much more profitable than they ever could be in the past because of technology, right? And you could run a business so much leaner than you had to in the past where you might have used to have to use 20 people for a business. And now you can use like three. And all that extra profit goes to you rather than to an extra 17 employees. So that's a subject that I've always had trouble with. And, you know, I don't know if you guys have much of an opinion there on either of those. I know it's a tough subject. That's fair play. So it's your chance to be president.
Well, gosh, it's such a complicated question. Before the real estate thing, I'm still thinking about the stocks and what, I don't know if you guys remember what Warren Buffett said in, John Bogle about the stock market's prediction and how they don't think that the stock market's going to go up higher than 4% per year on average. Mm-hmm. And it was just because interest rates dropped to zero pretty much. And if you look at the correlation between interest rates and the stock market, they're heavily, heavily correlated. So because we can't drop rates lower than zero, we can't really stimulate the stock market anymore. And so we're kind of left, you know, to it's left to its own devices. So
I don't know. We keep saying that we can't drop it below zero. Like zero is this threshold that's impossible to, you know, surpass. But I don't know. When you see other countries going with negative interest rates, I wouldn't put it at the impossible. I wouldn't say that's never going to happen. I wouldn't be surprised if at some point we briefly go negative, or we start doing negative rates on people holding, you know, $1 million in cash or whatever. Then all of a sudden you start charging those people. Parts of Europe, I think they're still doing that. I think it's possible. I would not be surprised if something happens, we go negative. Where all of a sudden on a 30-year mortgage, it's 0%. Like, it's nothing.
Yeah, I have a friend. He's a Danish friend of mine. And, you know, he's obviously knows a ton of people in Denmark. And he says he's got a, you know, a cousin that has a mortgage on a $500,000 house. You know, he bought it for $500,000. And somehow his payment is only like $700 a month, U.S. And I'm like, how does that even add up? And it wasn't like he did some crazy down payment or something like that in the house. But somehow with the interest rates and all the different stuff they have in Denmark, that he pays like $700 a month for a $500,000 house that he just bought recently. And I'm just like, how is that even possible?
Because you're saying because their interest rates are ridiculously low.
Yes. And then there were some other factors. I'll have to ask him and bring that back.
So, it's funny you mentioned that. Just last night, I was talking to my friend Alex. He lives in Germany. And he just told me that the interest rate on his apartment that he just recently bought, like about a year ago, was 1.77%. And that's kind of considered a high.
Yeah.
That's nuts. How?
Yeah. Crazy.
Yeah, I mean, you also look at it in conjunction with the inflation and with a whole bunch of other metrics as well. But, and especially imagine if they have deflation, then yeah, then you're getting lower rates. But yeah, I think it's absolutely, it's anything is possible at this point.
Can you imagine if we dropped interest rates on a 30-year mortgage to let's say like 1% or 0.5%, what that would do to home values? Like, people would just I don't know. We would go to like $700,000-$800,000 median home values.
Yeah, but that's how you keep the bubble going, Andre. You got to think a step ahead. How do you keep the money train going? You got to keep upping it, Andre. You got to think bigger here.
That's hey, a trouble.
That's the point. We want $700,000 condos.
Says the guy with a $10 million real estate portfolio.
Shh.
No,
I'm kidding.
Well, yeah, speaking of that, I did take out, you know, I bought a house. I just revealed that on my recent video. And so yeah, my mortgage was for a 7-year loan at 2.6%. For a $1 million loan.
See, you guys are the problem. You guys are the problem, okay?
See, I knew you were going to go there.
You're buying up all the houses, so then regular folks can't afford houses because you guys are so rich that you don't know what to do with the money.
Oh, yeah, sure. They're buying the regular house. Folks are buying Andre's multi-million-dollar house in a community of like $10
million. Multi-million-dollar house.
$1 million house in a community where the average price is like $5
million. Yeah, you know, I was thinking that as I was – like making my video and as I was filming it, I was like, I should just say I'm part of the problem, because it's like, it's not like it's easy to be like, well, it's the hedge funds, it's look at their money, but it's like it's also people like us who are buying these houses. And I guess the only justification or the way I'm rationalizing with myself is I'm not exactly buying like $300,000 homes, like median, like starter homes from families. You know, this is like a $1.3 million house. I don't think this is a I don't think I'm stealing from anybody who's in the middle class by buying that. And that's how I sleep well at night, knowing at least I'm not super part of the problem, but technically I think we all
I don't know,
are.
But you could even say that with buying like anything. You're buying stocks. Oh, well, yeah. You're a part of the problem because you made the S&P 500 go up a little bit because you're buying the index.
Yeah, but you could also argue that stocks are not essentials, whereas, you know, having a house to start a family kind of is. So it's a different thing.
I don't know. The whole thing goes back to building wealth really at the core, right? And so anything you do, like ideally, the best thing to probably do for the economy is like don't buy any stocks, don't invest at all, and spend all of your money would probably be the best for the economy. If everyone just spent all of their money and didn't invest, maybe economically, you know, things would be better. I don't know.
Sure.
That's a big question. You know, if you're talking about wealth inequality specifically, imagine if every person, let's say in the United States of America, at 18, 19 years old, had a pretty good base level of understanding of how the financials markets worked, how housing prices worked, how credit cards worked, savings accounts, you know, CD accounts. Imagine, and I just wonder, like, if we had that sort of society, If we would actually be in a much, much better place in wealth inequality and these sorts of things wouldn't be as big of a deal, or maybe it still is a big deal, you know, but I wish people were more educated.
So. I feel like if that was the case, Bitcoin would be like $1 million by now.
Yeah, what would realistically end up happening? People would save way more money. They would invest way more money, and they wouldn't spend as much. So I think you'd get a lot of services not seeing as much demand.
Yeah, but think about this for a moment, guys. I'll push back against that a little bit, because I think all three of us spend actually quite a bit of money out there, but mainly because what we did over time is we invested our money to put ourselves in a position where we could spend a lot more money. And I think if we had the mentality, let's say 10 years ago or 15 years ago, whenever we started our financial journeys, right? And let's say we had the mentality of just spending, I can tell you, I would have never built up to 200K in stocks. I would have never been able to start my real estate marketing company. I would have never started my YouTube channel and those sorts of things. So it's kind of like a butterfly effect where it's like, maybe you never get to, and I wouldn't be able to spend the type of money I'm able to spend. And it's only because I invested along the way, right? And that could possibly be true for all three of us. So, you know, it's butterfly effect, man. It's crazy. It's like one action does another action. So if you, one thing we do know is if you have more money, you spend a lot more money, right? Mm. That's just like factual. And I think all three of us are pretty frugal. With Graham and Andre, I think you guys are more frugal than me, but at the end of the day, all three of us are fairly frugal considering like what we have versus what we spend. But at the end of the day, you guys spend massively more than the average person. It's not even close, right? And you've got that because you continue to invest and continue to build your wealth and buy real estate and buy stocks and index funds and crypto and all these things, right? So I don't know, man.
The truth. Jeremy, let me ask, how many houses do you own now?
Only three.
Only three, you poor you.
His first thing is to say only.
Yeah. Well, it's because I'm on this show with somebody that owns like so many houses, I can't count them on both hands. So
Graham, you own how many? Like 12?
Eight.
No. Eight.
Eight.
Okay.
Only okay. Eight.
Only eight. When are you going to get to Kevin's level? Doesn't he own like 20 or something?
I don't know. I think it's definitely in the teens. I could be in the 20s. Something like that. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
Do you ever feel like I'm overweighted in real estate, or like I should diversify, or?
Me? No, not anymore. I did. And then I started buying index funds. And then now I feel like they're pretty evenly weighted, and now I could go back to maybe getting back into real estate. I think that's the choice I kind of want. I kind of feel better now that I'm even to go probably back into it, is because I love the consistent income of real estate that I don't get so much in stocks.
Having that idea, do you think it's a bad idea that I bought a house right now? Is it like it's a bad time?
I don't personally. I don't like the house that you bought. I don't think it's bad, but I think from a cash flow perspective,
you're right. No, cash flow perspective, there are. Yes, I would have been better off buying three or four $300,000 homes than that one. This is true. Yes.
Yeah.
The only reason, the reason I justified it as that, it wasn't so much for the cash flow or like even the price appreciation perspective. I just wanted to park my money somewhere. And it's a community that I've always wanted to live in. And I don't. If this house doesn't even cash flow and I can't rent it out, which would be impossible, then I would live in it and I would cash flow this house that I'm living in right now. So,
Andre, let me say something.
Wait, Jeremy. Okay. Yeah. One thing that Andre could have done instead of doing the house is put your money in cryptocurrency, all thanks to our video sponsor. Who is that, Andre? Is that FTX?
It's FTX.
Are they one of the largest and most complete U.S. regulated cryptocurrency exchanges in the world, with over 6 million users who buy, sell, track, and trade cryptocurrencies and NFTs all in one place, right from their phone? Is that FTX? Are they also down below in the description?
They're down there in the description, and now you can even use them to buy stocks, which is pretty amazing. So now stocks and crypto, FTX.
And NFTs.
Yeah, and can't you do with FTX? Buy $1 million house? Maybe they have that coming next.
You can't convince Jeremy to buy crypto, that's for sure.
But see, Andre could have used them because they have no fixed minimum fees on transactions. They got no ACH fees, no withdrawal fees, and no NFT fees on the top Ethereum and Solana collections. They're also one of the most popular cryptocurrency tracking platforms, which allow their users to track prices throughout more than 10,000 different options. And you could get free crypto on every trade over $10. Like, I just bought Bitcoin the other day, and I got a free Dogecoin. Mm. I thought that was kind of neat. So if you're interested, the link is down below in the description. And like I said, their fees are up to 85% lower than some of their top competitors. So if you're interested, they do sponsor the channel. We love them. They are down below in the description. And Andre, you could have done that instead of buying your house.
This is true. I should have done that.
Man, Andre, I wish I had that money. I wish I would buy so many Tattoo Chef and Honest Shares. Planet, $2. Ah!
How many millions of dollars did you already invest into Tattoo Chef?
An undisclosed amount. No, I have just a small seven-figure.
Yes, all of it.
Don't even get me started on the chef, because I'll just start going on a 20-minute tangent on talking about the bullish thesis. Okay, let's just go to the next slide before I start talking.
Jeremy, hold on. Wait.
Okay.
What hasn't happened for Tattooed Chef that still needs to? Like, I feel like we've gone through the Roni Rona. People have been indoors. You know, that whole thing happened, and now we're out of that. Now there's fear in the market. Like, what needs to happen on a macro scale for TTCF to take off to the moon?
I think, oh boy, we're going to have to do a history lesson, okay?
Give me, like, in a nutshell.
No one ever heard of Tattooed Chef 18 months ago. And they've went from, they were in almost no stores 18 months ago. No one ever heard of the brand 18 months ago. To now you walk into a Target store and there are freezers full of Tattooed Chef items. And they have four of the top five best-selling frozen entrees out there. It's absolutely amazing. They're tearing it up. And as far as the underlying business model, it's doing amazing. They're going through a time period where the market's not respecting their stock price because everything's getting hammered, which we're about to get into small caps. This will be a nice transition. But in this sort of market, if you're a small cap stock, it doesn't matter what you're doing on your business model right now. You're not getting any love. I don't know any small caps that are getting love in this market outside of maybe energy because oil is going so insane. But most of those are mids and large. So there's really nothing Tattooed Chef can do right now with their business model. Like, for instance, the next quarter, doesn't matter what growth rate they report, the stock's probably, quote unquote, probably not making a huge move, just because if the market doesn't want to buy it, the market doesn't want to buy it. And that's
what's the PE ratio of TTCF right now?
Well, they're not profitable yet, so they have no PE ratio, but their price to sales, which is kind of how you're going to value like a growth stock, their price to sales is about a 3. Their forward price to sales is probably like a 3.3, something like that, which is fairly low for how high of a growth company they are. But yeah, a stock like that, you're not going to get love. You're not going to get love until the market switches and wants to go risk on. And we don't know when that's going to happen.
But weren't we risk on not that long ago? Like, I mean, it's only recently that we got risk off. So what happened there?
Yeah, and risk on was when Chef went over 20, you know, and the stock was doing really well. And then as soon as the market started to flip, and then the Chef, they messed up a quarterly report essentially where they had to postpone last minute. Between those two things, the stock just got devastated, and that's why it's like a $12 stock here today. So, but yeah, I mean, it's amazing because the stock's actually held up pretty well. The stock's up in the past month. It's up in the past 6 weeks, despite all these other stocks getting absolutely devastated. So there might just be a core shareholder base that understands what's going on.
I think it could have very well hit a point because what do they say? When a stock hits bottom, it's when even negative news doesn't affect it. And it seems like Tattooed Chef is one of those of probably a dozen stocks that's like, no matter what, like Robinhood, I think is an example of like how much worse can things get, but Robinhood's still at $10 to $11. It's like, no matter what happens at this point, Robinhood is $10 to $11.
Right.
There's quite a few companies that trade around that same range, not necessarily at $10 to $11, but who just, no matter what happens, it's just, well, the stock price trades within a 5% window.
The tough thing, and I'll say this about, in the difference between like a Tattooed Chef and maybe an Honest as well and some of these other companies versus like maybe a Robinhood or some of the meme stocks that maybe some folks were in, is Tattooed Chef has incredible revenue growth and should for years to go in the future, like just grow and grow and grow, right? Honest is the same situation. Some of these stocks like Robinhood, their revenue could potentially go negative over the next couple quarters. And so you have a very different fundamental thing going on with those business models, the actual underlying business models. In a devastating market, it's going to hit all stocks. But if you can't grow, your stock's not going to be respected. So that's just the way it is. But, you know, looking at this here, guys, the small S&P 600 small cap, and I know this might be a little niche for a lot of people, but I like to introduce folks to the rabbit hole sometimes. So what we're looking at is just think about these as smaller companies in general, a lot of companies with maybe, you know, $1 billion, $2 billion dollar type valuations, things like that. By the way, Corsair is going to get included into the S&P 600 small caps, which is really bullish news for that. Nice. But if you look at this, right now we're trading at like a 13.7 for S&P 600 small caps. In every single time you've gotten around this range or below, it's you very shortly after went into a massive bull market. It happened in 02, 03. It happened in 08, 09. It happened in around 2011 into kind of 12. And it happened in March of 2020. In every single one of those, within a few months, you started this massive upward bull market that lasted usually a couple years. So maybe this is that one time where it's like, maybe this is different. I don't see it that way. It's just you can stay at these valuations for maybe a few months, but it's completely unsustainable. And eventually you're going to go on a massive bull run. And that's what I see playing out. It's just like, when does it start? Is it like a few weeks, a few months, you know, the end of this year? We don't know. But, you know, the chart's pretty attractive. What do you guys think about something like that? You might not usually look at that, but what's your opinion on that?
Introducing Wondersuite from Bluehost.com, the tool that makes WordPress wonderful for everyone. Website creation is hard, but now with Bluehost, you can answer a few simple questions about your business and goals, and the Wondersuite tools will automatically lay out your WordPress website or store in minutes. Seriously. From there, you can customize your design, pick your brand colors, and add blocks. No custom theme or coding required. You'll get content suggestions that you can keep or revise. And with Yoast SEO built in, we automatically help you get found in search engines. From step-by-step guidance to suggested plugins to an AI-powered help bot, our built-in tools make WordPress wonderful for everyone. Whether you're a beginner or a pro, you can join over 2 million Bluehost users. Go to bluehost.com/wondersuite. That's bluehost.com/wondersuite.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage? Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
Is this considered technical analysis?
No, I'm just, not really. No, this is actually more fundamental analysis. I just
like, look at this blue line. It's never been lower than that. That means it's going to go up soon.
Yeah,
I don't know. I mean, as you see, though, in 2008 and 2009, it did get significantly worse, but I don't know. I wouldn't be surprised if there's a regular rotation, just as I wouldn't be surprised if things stay at this level for longer than expected. Even if you look at 2001, 2002, 2003, went up and then it dipped right back down again. We could see a similar position to that. Could stay down for longer than expected. I think anything like this, whatever you don't expect is going to happen, will happen.
Okay, you guys could discuss. I'm gonna try to overlay this graph right here with interest rates, and I want to see how it lines up, because my suspicion is that every time these charts have gone up, I feel like interest rates have started to decline in those environments.
Now, I was going to say, Andre, if we wanted to take it one step further, we would also overlay the S&P 600 small cap on top of that, and then we could have three things overlaid. No, because that would be quite interesting. I don't know if you could do that or not, but that would be amazing.
I'm just going to say, my hypothesis is in the time that it goes up is when the Federal Reserve started to decrease the interest rates. And because we are near zero still, we don't have that same catalyst for us to go back up. And that was the whole thing I just mentioned before with Warren Buffett and John Bogle saying the same thing, where it's like, we don't have the cannon. We don't have the cannon power anymore to get us to go back up like that, because our interest rates are already so low. There's no macro catalyst like that. So hold on. Let me find some Fred St. Louis.
That's an interesting thought there, Andre. Yeah, I would love to see that as well. But what you do, I think it is important to understand about these sorts of time periods is, like you looked at their Graham where it touched below this line in 02, 03. So that's over probably a 6 month span there. 08, 09, we were at, down there for, that's probably 6 months, 9 months. 2011, 12, that's probably only like a month or two there. And obviously March of 2020, that was for maybe a month or two there. So, but at the end of the day, you can remain low like this for potentially several months. And I think that's an important part. And that's why I can't really like play short-term call options. Although it's very tempting to like, be like, I'm going to play 3 month out call options or something. Can't do it because you can easily stay in these ranges for several months. And so it's like, you know, you're likely going to get a boom, but you know, you have to kind of play the waiting game there. So,
right.
I can't wait to see your technical analysis here, Andre, you fancy chart man. Oh my God.
What are you talking about? I never use charts.
You're just out here charting Bitcoin all day, day trading it, making millions, buying million-dollar houses. Oh my gosh, man.
Jesus, no.
Incredible. So, Alex, if you want to take it to the next slide in the meantime, and then Andre can keep prepping this. So I thought you guys would think this is interesting. Vegas home prices are talking about, you know, they can't keep climbing this fast forever. Median sales price of previously owned single family homes, the bulk of the market, was $450,000 in February, up 3.4%, or $15,000 just from the all-time record, which was set in January. Last month's median price was almost 27% above where we were at in February of 2021. And it's just incredible, these numbers. This person says, LVR president says, local home prices can't keep going up this fast forever. The increases we've been seeing in the last year are so not sustainable, which I agree with. I don't know if you guys have a perspective on that.
Yeah, what they don't tell you is that sustainable is totally different from they can't be sustained at this level. So no, I do not think, can we go up 30% a year every year? Absolutely not. That's not sustainable. But can we go up 30% and then stay at that same price for an extended period of time? That, I think, is a different story. So it seems like overall, everyone is saying these increases are unsustainable. And I agree with that. But at the same time, even CoreLogic says that they expect housing prices to go up, I think, 4%. Zillow was the most ambitious. Zillow expects housing prices to increase another 18% over the next year. Zillow. Redfin, I think, was like 12%. But I mean, it seems to be that, I think home price growth is beginning to taper off. It's beginning to be a little slower. But I think maybe housing prices could stay pretty high.
And in terms of your feelings around that, Graham, is that based upon any data you're looking at, or just kind of like your overall feeling and kind of the vibes of the market that you're feeling were kind of tapering off this?
That's based on their analysis. But also when you look objectively at the housing market, there's not a lot right now that would cause a very sudden decline in values. What you would have to see a panic of people wanting to sell their homes. But even then, people have locked in such low interest rates that they don't want to leave. And that's something that we saw happen back in 2011. People 2011 to 2016, people locked in very low interest rates. And I remember in 2016, a lot of sellers were hesitant to move. And that's what led to an initial housing shortage, because people had locked in these low rates. They didn't want to go anywhere, because if they had to move, well, then they're getting up that mortgage and getting something more expensive. And if housing prices are the same, it just costs them more money. So we did see a slight decline in, I think it was 2018, towards the end of 2018, when the Fed was more ambitious of raising rates. So that's something we could see. But even then, I think the decline was limited to certain regions, up to 8 to 10%. I think like San Diego was like 10%. But that was the worst of it. So
can you remind folks, Graham, you know, because obviously you were in LA at that time, you know, in the 08, 09 recession crash, whatever you want to call it, which, you know, for real estate still hit till like 2011. Did LA real estate get hit hard during that time? Did it not?
Yeah, it did. It depends on the area. Some prices were down about, I would say almost everything was down like 30%. So it didn't matter what it is, that's 30%. But that's from the peak in like 2006. And then some other areas in California were hit like 80%. San Bernardino and Riverside and parts like Fresno. Palmdale, I think, was another big hard hit area. All of those areas, you could buy a house for like 80% of its value in 2006, 2005. So yes, certain areas were hit a lot harder. Even Beverly Hills was like 30, 40%. So yes, everywhere got hard.
When did you buy your first property? 2011?
Sorry.
2011.
Okay.
So there, this is the overlay of the interest rate. So it kind of corresponds, Jeremy. I mean, look at that. So from 99 to, let's say, 2002, you see interest rates falling. And look at the stock market in that same time period.
Okay, so it's
going up. Okay, look at another one. Look at the 08 area. 08, you could see we're starting to drop. Look at that. S&P 600 shooting up.
Well, let me clear this up because I think there might be some confusion here. So what we're looking at here, this is S&P 600 small cap forward PE metric. So this isn't, we would have to overlay the S&P 600 index in order to see really what you want to see here, Andre. So unfortunately, I think we might have to add another line in if possible.
I'll find it.
Okay. Because that would be good because just for reference here, forward PE, for folks that maybe don't know, that's looking at a company's next 12 months of expected earnings, right? Versus their market capitalization. So let's say you're a company that's expected to have $100 million of net income next year over the next 12 months, right? You divide it out by your market cap. Let's say it's $1 billion. You have a forward P of 10, right? And so you would be on a 10 scale. And so looking at this, it can kind of be confusing sometimes because companies can obviously, their earnings can go up and down and all around. So it's not a direct correlation, but I'm going to be interested to see that. But back to you, Graham. So you bought your first piece of real estate in 2011. Was that the bottom of the market in 11? Did you buy your first right around the bottom? Or?
Yes, pretty much the bottom, plus or minus maybe like a few months. But yeah, that was pretty much the bottom because I got a lot of these properties under contract earlier than that where the market was just as bad. And that was at the time where housing values started to go up in value to the point where you would make an offer with the bank and the bank would take like 3 to 6 months to get back to you. And you started to see banks asking for more money. We're talking maybe 5-10 grand. I mean, you know, but they started to say, well, you know, things are maybe turning around. We're going to ask for a little bit more and they'll get it. So yeah, it was, I locked in at the bottom and then within a little bit from there.
And was that like a super memorable day for you when you bought your first property or not really?
Yeah, it was.
It was? Okay.
No, absolutely.
How'd you get that property? Was it a client or is it just a house you saw out there and you're like, I want to buy this or condo?
No, it was a house I saw. So I had a client. And so initially I had a client who was buying a lot of properties in San Bernardino. And I looked at this guy and he was so smart. He was a guy from Beverly Hills, had a lot of money, was really successful. What was it? I think he was a lawyer or a doctor. I think he was a lawyer. And he's buying all these properties on the side. And I was the one writing those offers. And when I saw him writing, like he would write multiple offers. He'd just say, send an address, write an offer for this price, send it to the bank. Just get in the habit of doing that. And I started to realize, wait a second, let me look into this area too. So I started doing a lot of research into the area because before he would just tell me, I want this property. I didn't know why. So I started spending every single weekend driving to San Bernardino, seeing like 20 homes. You know, every time I'd be out there, go and see homes. I did that for months. And pretty quickly, you get a good understanding of like what these houses are worth, what they're renting for. And it got to a point where it was such an easy decision because the replacement value of this house, like if you wanted to rebuild these houses, it was like 250, 300 grand. And it didn't make any sense to me how you could buy a house for $60,000 to $100,000 that costs $300,000 to build again. And to me, that was such a sure thing that it was like, it doesn't matter what the value is. I'm buying this for a fraction of its replacement value. So I felt so comfortable about dumping everything I had because it's like, it was so cheap relative to what it should cost. I'm like, there's no way this could be sustained forever.
That's genius. And then, but that house, you didn't live in it, right? Did you rent it or how'd that
work? Rented out.
Wow. That's incredible. So you bought your first house wasn't even for you. It was just for a rental and you still rented your, so when, what house number were you at when you finally lived in a property that you owned then?
House number. Well, all so I bought three at the same time. So that was like 1, 2, 3 back to back. The fourth property. That was the one I bought. Yeah.
Okay, we got to get into this. How did you buy three at all at the same time? Do you have some massive commission, or you just been saving money like crazy? Oh,
it's tough for me because I've explained this so many times. But
I'm sorry. Might not know. As your friend, I don't even actually know this story, so true. I apologize.
That was 3.5 almost. That was almost 4 years of saving as a real estate agent. So because I started selling real estate in 2008, it was like April 2008 is when I started. So I just saved as much as I possibly could. And I used 3.5 to almost 4 years of savings. And some of those, like I knew I had deals that were about to close. So I'd be like, you know, rolling those commissions into buying these places, just knowing that, okay, this is going to close. And I have this commission closing that'll pay for that. And then I'd close, but then I wouldn't have the money for a renovation. But I knew that, like, okay, this deal was supposed to close escrow in like 2 weeks after that. So in 2 weeks, I'll have the money to use on that. So I basically rolled everything I had into these properties. But one was 60 grand. The other was 70 grand. The other was 115.
Wow. Those prices, you know, that wasn't even what I was thinking. I was thinking like it would be like $500,000, like a $700,000. That's crazy.
That's what I was saying. So it's like I'm buying these properties at like 60 to 80 for, you know, 60, 70 grand, doing minimal repairs because most of them were in good condition. It's just the market took a hit, nothing to do with the house. So, yeah.
So everybody in the comment section, we need to know if you knew that story or not. If you're a real Graham fan, if you knew that story that Graham just told right there, okay?
Yeah, but now it's a lot different, and it's weird for me because I made so many housing videos, teaching like here's what you do to find a house, here's what's undervalued, but a lot, and I made those videos with the expectation that it would be the same 10 years from now, but now it's like you go back to those videos I made 4 years ago, and you can't. It's not like you could find a property that's under market value because back then, like even 3 years ago, it was entirely possible to tell people, hey, you got to find a home that's 15% under market. Buy that home. You're in instant equity. Fix it up. You'll make 30% pretty quick.
The wedge deals, deal.
Yeah, the wedge deal. Those deals don't exist. I'm sure they do, but the amount of time and effort it takes to find those deals is is your time better spent elsewhere? Maybe
so,
it is.
So the vertical, what do you call them? Not velocity. Gosh, what's the right word for it? The intensity of the verticals is not to scale.
Yeah.
But you can kind of see a picture here. So if you look at 2000, starting at 2000, right? Interest rates drop. You could see the market starts to pick up. Interest rates go up in 2004. Guess what? Market goes down. After 08, you could see interest rates drop to zero. Going to 2010 to 2016, you could see interest rates are zero. The market's going up and up and up and up until 2018, 2019, let's say, right? Interest rates start to go up and it cuts off at the top, but you can see that it falls off. The market actually falls off.
Mm-hmm.
In 2019. Now that was Rona, so maybe that's not quite interest rate related, but kind of lines up. And then we drop rates to zero again and the market takes back up again. So it's the same thing. It's the exact opposite. Rates go to zero, market grows. Rates go up, market goes down.
Yeah, I disagree a little bit. So Alex, if you want to roll us a little bit over to the side there. So for instance, you see rates start to go up in 04, right? And rates keep going up all the way to 06, 07 roughly, and then they taper off. But during that time, the market goes up from 04 to 06, 07, where it peaked, I think it's peaked in summer of 2007. I mean, the market kept going up. So, and rates were going down, for instance, in the, let's see, the tech bubble time. And meanwhile, during that time, well, see, this is the confusing part because we're looking at S&P 600, but I remember that the market got absolutely wrecked. From 2000 to about 2002, NASDAQ, S&P, pretty much everything, because the tech bubble blew up, obviously. And that was in a time period where they were dropping rates from over 6%, it looks like, in 2000, about 1% by the time we got to 2003. And then rates started going back up, but the market started going back up after that. So I don't know, man. I don't see
this will help if the graph was like more to scale. with the vertical, but I don't know how to get it to that point. But yeah. Either way, I just think if the Fed has used up all of its firepower to drop rates to zero, there's not much of a catalyst for risk on to get back into it, which kind of, I think, backs up, you know, Kevin's macro thesis, right? Like, that's why he left, because he thought the Fed was against us. And I think to some degree, he was right. It's just like, I don't think it's smart to try to time the market. And in some way, I could see his perspective. He's trying to time the cycle, not necessarily like individual stocks.
Just so you know, Kevin's like mostly invested now.
He's invested now. He's like 70% in, right?
Yeah.
He's gotten back into it. So that's kind of invalidates this theory, but
yeah. But I think, you know, looking at this, guys, it's an interesting perspective. Because I was thinking about this the other day. We're almost very brainwashed, and maybe it's right, maybe it's wrong, but we're almost like brainwashed on, we think the only way the economy can do well and stocks can go up and these sorts of things is if rates are at zero, right?
Right.
And I don't know. We'll see, obviously, over time if that's true. But I mean, you look at, for instance, rates started going up in, you know, 15, 16, and the economy still was doing well as we went into 17, 18, 19. And we'll never know if they kept going rates up in 20, what would have happened there if we never had Rona. But I mean, I think we're almost like not giving the U.S. economy enough credit nowadays. And we think the only way we can have a prosperous economy and the only way we can have stock price going up is if we have rates at zero. And I don't buy into it, to be honest. I think we've just been brainwashed to think the Fed's the hero. And that's the only thing.
But Jeremy, that's because, and I actually did a video on this, so I pulled it up, the information. So look, it would help if we had some picture to overlay it, but just okay, so hear me out. Between 1964, right, to 1981, the GDP went from 670 to 3,124. So it 4.6x'd in that 17-year time frame. Now, you would think then the stock market would also go up, at least somewhat in line with that. But it actually went down. In 1964, the S&P started at 700. And by 1981, even though the GDP 4x'd, we went down to 418, almost by half. So, you know, that was a huge drag because of interest rates, because in that same time period, interest rates went up like crazy. That was the crazy inflation that we had. So, So that's why people say this, like, that's all people pay attention to. And that's the whole phrase, like, don't fight the Fed, right? Mm-hmm. And I could see that. So I could see why people are trying to somewhat time using interest rates, because they are so important.
Yeah, and I think looking back at that time frame, you know, might not be the best context. I know a lot of people do it, and they look and they're like, look at, but I mean, think about it. You know, if you could get 8%, 10%, 12% on a savings account or bonds or whatever, I mean, gosh, you know, why put the money in the market when it's like guaranteed like that? And I could tell you, it would be a very bad thing if suddenly tomorrow, savings accounts, bonds, everything yielded you 8%, 9%, 10%. The stock market would drop 20-30% the next day.
Yeah. I think so. Stock at market least. Would crash so hard.
Yeah. Yep, 100%. The market would crash the very next day, vicious, and would for like weeks or maybe months go in the future until it finally normalized. But, you know, the question is, do we ever get back to those sorts of numbers? Because I feel like you almost need like at least 4%. To get on like a savings account, if not higher than that, to really get your attention and be like, you know what, instead of putting money in the S&P 500 today, I'm going to put money in a savings account. Is there a specific number you guys look at?
That's a great question. I've always thought about that too. Like, what threshold does it come a point to where bonds make more sense than stocks? There has to be a much more clearly defined way to explain it, but I don't know exactly how.
Yeah, the last survey, there was a study that was done in terms of interest rates and risk taking, and they determined that I think it was when interest rates dropped below, I think it was like 4%, it encouraged excessive risk taking. Mm. I think 5% was the point where people began to place more money in safer assets. So I would guess it would probably be somewhere around 5%.
Ooh, okay. So around 5% would be that number. So if Ally, let's say, gave you 5% tomorrow, Graham, that would be the one where you're like, you know what? I might just go savings account today instead of index fund. Huh?
Very tempting. Extremely tempting.
Do you think a lot of that has to do with people's debt and the interest rate on their debt? It's like, you know, would I rather pay down a guaranteed, like if my interest rate on my debt, say 3%, then I probably wouldn't want to put it in a bond at 4%. I'd rather risk it in the stock market at 7%, right? So it's like, it's almost like you have a guaranteed built-in return into debt. So if you're somebody who has credit card debt or a home loan, and it's say 3-4% interest on that loan, then you know paying down that debt gives you a guaranteed rate of whatever the debt is at. So I feel like the question really depends on people's debt levels and the interest rate on their debt.
Oh, you guys know what we're looking at here? Mean allocations to risky asset in different interest.
Oh, yeah, yeah. So this is it. So as you can see, when interest rates were zero, 70% of people allocated money to riskier assets versus when interest rates were 5%, that declined to 50. So only 50, half the people. And so as you can see, then obviously it continues from there. But yeah, 5-10% is the point where you see a big drop off, even 3%, a big drop off between.
Okay, this look at the 10-15%. Who in their right mind at 15% doesn't just put all their money into that bond?
Yeah, but most likely at 15% example is probably high inflation, or there's something where interest rates have to be at 15% to make sense.
Yeah, but why wouldn't there be more people like 70% at that point?
Well, let me ask you, Andre, if you could get guaranteed 10% from the bank tomorrow, would you continue to put money in Bitcoin?
100%.
You would still put money in Bitcoin?
1,000%.
What if it's 15%?
No, I already answered. 1,000% is when I wouldn't consider it.
Okay, I got you.
I'm kidding. No, at what point? That's a good question. Like you're saying, at what point does the bank have to offer me for me to not invest in Bitcoin?
Yeah, to say I'm not putting new money if I got an extra $10,000 to invest this week or this month.
The way for me to answer that question, I guess, is to look at the historical return of Bitcoin, which has been, I think, average of 200%. So I guess somewhere in that ballpark. Now, it's not going to be 200% per year for the next 10 years. It'll probably be closer to, I don't know. I have to do the math on that, but it would depend. But I would say 200% is the starting point to get me interested.
It would be interesting. I could tell you it'd be interesting to see, what happens with Bitcoin in an environment where you could actually get good returns from just a savings account or CD accounts or bonds or whatever, right? Because Bitcoin's grown up its entire life in basically an interest rates at zero type environment, right?
Right.
And so it'll be interesting to just see how specifically crypto asset class and specifically Bitcoin, how those will react in that sort of environment.
So, but I feel like we're going to be in that environment for like indefinitely. I don't think we'll ever climb back up to the time of the 70s, 80s, 90s. Like we're never going to see interest rates at 6-7% just for decades. Like, I don't think we're ever going back to that era.
Wow. Famous last words. We're next year at this time.
No, I'm not saying we'll never be there. I'm saying that we won't revert to the median there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Jay Powell goes crazy over the next year. And he's like, guys, we're raising 1 percentage point every time.
He's watching this video. He's like, wait, what'd you say to me? Oh, no.
Let me show them wrong.
Oh,
for you, Andre.
So this is a fun subject here. So this guy who owns Fashion Nova, which if you've ever gone on Instagram one time in your life, you're sure you heard of Fashion Nova before. He bought that crazy epic house in LA, 21 bedrooms, 49 bathrooms. I think he stole the house, 141 mil. And I think originally they were asking 500 million.
500, yeah, I remember, yeah.
Dude, I'm thinking he probably bought it as some sort of business expense. I'll probably do photo shoots for the models and stuff. I'm like, it's genius. I think my personal opinion, that's actually a great buy, and he stole the house. I think he stole it. I don't think you could rebuild that house.
No, you couldn't.
Yeah.
The guy was in it. Like, I think, what was it? $190 million. That's how much the guy spent over 10 years just to build the house. And then you also have to account for all the time, the expertise. There's no way you could rebuild that house today with the new zoning requirements. I actually thought he got a good deal on it too. But you got to think, how many people realistically are out there wanting to be in the market to buy this house? Very few. And I agree. I think it's going to be like the Wish house. I think Wish has been buying and leasing. some really nice properties, and they're using them as places for like influencers, photo shoots, just like talking you said,
Woods.com.
Yeah. So I wouldn't be surprised if they're doing this and they're going to find a way to write off the majority of it as like some sort of business expense.
Just for some reference, Wish has been trading around $1 a share recently. So,
dang.
But Grant, how I will say,
do you remember going to the dude's house for New Year's?
Yeah, I do.
That was interesting.
Not my favorite night, but yeah.
Yeah, that was.
I'm just not one for parties, and when there's too many people, I don't.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
No, that's it fair. So, yeah, I will say, man, imagine, you know, in a city of the rich, right, which is L.A., this guy's got the house in L.A. Like, how that's such a flex on all the other rich people that it's like, no matter what house you have, I have a better house than you. So I just say that's a flex, man. But
yeah, but does he have a Bored Ape? No, I'm kidding.
Yeah. It's like, I actually have a whole collection, but no.
Yeah. I have a whole menagerie.
Yeah.
Oh, gosh. Yeah, I mean, I think we all agree. He stole this house. Good for him. Crazy, crazy, crazy. That's all I'll say about that. You know, how long that took to build? Insane. All right, what else we got here, Alex? Ooh, all right, Andre. I got this one specifically for you. Biden is supposed to have some executive order on crypto tomorrow. Do you have expectations of this? What are you hearing?
Why tomorrow? What do you know that I don't know? Tomorrow?
Yeah.
Is it tomorrow?
Yeah, it should be tomorrow. My friend said it was supposed to be Wednesday. So tomorrow's Wednesday.
Oh, as far as I'm aware, we've been hearing it's supposed to be next week for like 2 months now. Yeah. I don't think
we're going to hear anything. So even this is off CoinDesk from today. It says the order, which is expected to be issued this week. And my friend is a fairly reliable source, and he was telling me Wednesday. So
okay, so all right, I'll be honest. I have a video coming out tomorrow about it, so you can learn more there. But
ooh.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah. But it's
a little something.
What's up?
You got to give us a little something here on what you're thinking.
Yeah. So no, Graham was right. We've been talking about this. I feel like for the last month or two, where it's like, oh, it's next week. It's coming. It's coming. It was supposed to be February for a long time now. And the reason that it's coming now and we're talking about it again is because our Congress doesn't really understand how crypto works nor technology. And they seem to think that foreign countries are going to use crypto, during war to go around the financial sanctions. And so they're afraid. They don't want Russia, China using crypto to trade with each other. And so they want to get these regulations out ASAP. And that's why they're pushing it for this week. But we don't know exactly what's going to be in this executive order other than kind of like the major talking points. But it's kind of going to be a nothing burger. Like it's going to be Joe Biden basically telling government agencies to look into creating policies, regulations, studies, and then reporting back. That's all it's basically mm-hmm. saying, you, go figure out what this thing is all about, report back to me, and then we'll figure it out later. That's all this is going to be, really. The biggest threat, the biggest thing that this executive order, I think, would have in it is a call to the EPA, right, the Environmental Protection Agency, to look into the carbon emissions footprint for Bitcoin. And, they're just going to try to see what the impact is. And that's going to be the biggest catalyst for, you know, Bitcoin to be, I guess, created into a spot ETF, right? That's going to be the scarier point. But they did some studies on the carbon emissions footprint. And it's pretty insane, like what it revealed. And I'll share with you in the video the statistics. But it's like it's crazy because Bitcoin has such a bad rep about being, you know, a waste of resources and that it's not efficient. But anyway, I don't want to go too deep into it, but it's really good what they found.
Okay.
As long as the EPA does a good job and stays objective about their research, then Bitcoin will be fine. But it's going to be a nothing burger. I don't think it's going to be a bad. If anything, it's a great thing because regulation has been like this dark cloud hanging over Bitcoin. But once we get some clarity, it'll be great. Unfortunately, I don't think this executive order is going to get any clarity on anything.
Okay. Well, it's interesting to know because I think a lot of people hear executive order and they think this is some sort of final decision and he's going to come down with a sledgehammer. But you're basically saying no.
No, it's going to assign committees on subcommittees on committees to look on whatever they could find, because yeah, they have no idea what they're dealing with.
What are your sources saying, Graham?
Same thing as Andre. I think it's going to be absolutely nothing. They've been saying it's going to be next week for like a month, some maybe even 2 months. It's been, as far as I'm aware, it's for developing, like, instead of that you have the SEC, you know, on securities, they want to develop a new framework for regulation over cryptocurrency to make sure these silly rug pulls stop happening, and better defining what is a security, what is a currency, promotion. I think there's going to be a lot. I think a lot of good overall is going to come from it.
Yeah. It's funny though. There's been two agencies in the government that have been fighting over the regulation for crypto, and that's the SEC and the CFTC, right? The CFTC, the Commodity Futures Trading Commission, which they're the guys that in 2015, they were like, ah, Bitcoin's a commodity. This is a good thing. We want Bitcoin to be a commodity. But the SEC wants to be really tough on crypto. So it's like good cop, bad cop. The SEC is the bad cop because they want to take a tough stance on crypto. And the reason they want to do that is, I don't know if you guys watched Jon Stewart's video recently where he was talking to Gary Gensler, and he made a joke to Gary, and he's like, dude, you guys have donations for coffee in your office. How can you guys expect to fight billion-dollar hedge funds when you guys have literally coffee donations in your office? Like, you are outgunned. And part of the reason why the SEC wants control or regulatory control over Bitcoin is because Bitcoin is money. Money is influence. It's power. And anytime you have a government agency that can influence and regulate power, they become powerful, right? Because they get tax dollars, they get money, they can expand. And the SEC is in desperate need of funding and expansion, because otherwise the AMC, the GameStop, the meme stock movement, that wouldn't have happened, because their job is to protect the regular retail investor from unfair capital markets, which they didn't do. And the reason they didn't do it is because they're just not big enough, they're not powerful enough, they don't have enough money. And that's why they want their hands on crypto, because it gives them that reason to expand. But anyway, more about that in the video tomorrow.
Ooh, that's interesting. Yeah, it sounds like, to me, what my conspiracy theory brains tells me is the Wall Street wants in crypto in a major way. They want to set up a ton of ETFs and funds and different things in the crypto space because crypto's gotten big enough now. And so finally they're getting the politicians on board. That's what my little conspiracy.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. It's not, I don't think it's a conspiracy at all. It's actually one step closer for us to get the spot ETF.
Mm.
Once we put those regulations in place and clarity, and then we have some protections going, then the playing field is open.
Yeah.
I agree with that.
Yeah. Now we just got to wait and see. All right, gentlemen, you got anything else? Overtime, I think that's all I had prepped for slides here tonight. Anything on your guys' minds you saw out there this week or anything like that?
It's been interesting. What have you been buying, Jeremy?
Let's see. Today I bought PayPal. I bought Honest. So I bought about $10,000 worth of PayPal. I bought $5,700 worth of Honest and $6,300 worth of Oatly, which they're going to be reporting earnings soon, which I'm not expecting much out of the stock price. That's just a long-term buy that I'll probably continue to buy for like the next 6 months. So, and I'm still waiting on some of my other small caps to report. Planet still has to report. Tattoo Chef still has to report. Honest still has to report. So, yeah. What about you guys? I'm assuming the normal stuff. Well, Graham, you said something about, so you bought some PayPal.
Yeah, I bought some PayPal when it was today. No, I think it was yesterday. Yesterday during the big sell off, I bought some PayPal, and I think Coinbase as well. I mean, it's so small compared to everything else, but you know, I'm still buying a little bit here and there, mostly S&P, and then I've been investing just as much also into the international ETF, which has gotten hit very hard. So now I'm officially negative on that fund. I've actually lost money on that fund. Even though I've been buying it now for almost 2 years. But buying it cheaper.
So Which fund?
It's called Schwab International. It's SC. Why HD? Am I blanking here? No, it's something F. SCHF.
Oh.
Okay. Schwab International Equity ETF.
Mm.
Been buying some Schiffa.
Yeah, I mean, if you really wanted to play a little dangerous, right? Well, I wouldn't call it dangerous, but if you want to play an index, you could look to Europe. Well, I don't know if you guys track the European markets, but some of those markets are down 25-30+% right now. They just gotten absolutely hammered. So much, much harder than we've gotten hit in the States. So, but yeah, what about you, Andre? Any interesting buys, NFTs, crypto? What we got, man?
No, I just spent so much money buying the house.
Dang it. That's boring, Andre. We want fun stuff.
I know, right? You're like, what? You're doing adult things? That's not fun.
You know what stock I wish I could buy if only it was a public company is our sponsor for this video, FTX.
FTX.
Thank you for sponsoring today's video. Make sure you guys check out the link in the description down there and set up an account. FTX is amazing. So a lot coming for FTX. And Graham, you want to take us home?
Yeah. So guys, like Jeremy mentioned, check out FTX in the description. They do have fees that are up to 85% lower than the competition. And the coolest part about all of it is that you get free crypto with every trade over $10. So, you know, what other places do that? So if you want, like I mentioned, I got a Dogecoin. It was free. You may as well. It's free. So thank you guys so much for watching. Also, what else is free is subscribing, hitting the like button, commenting down below for the algorithm. And that's it. Thank you guys so much for watching. And until next time.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Prescription products require completion of an online medication consultation with an independent healthcare provider through the LifeMD platform and are only available if prescribed. Subscription required. Individual results may vary. Additional restrictions apply. Read all warnings before using GLP-1s. Side effects may include a risk of thyroid C-cell tumors. Do not use GLP-1s if you or your family have a history of thyroid cancer.
If you've struggled for years to lose weight and have given up hope, did you know you can now access GLP-1 prescription medications at TryLifeMD.com? We're now offering eligible patients online access to GLP-1s, the breakthrough prescription medication that can help you lose body fat and weight. Listen to what people are saying.
It's fun to put on jeans that you couldn't get into 6 months ago.
Every morning, I look forward to getting on the scale.
For anybody who's struggling with their weight, it's a godsend.
And here's the best part. Your insurance may cover 100% of the cost of your medication. So go to TryLifeMD.com to have your eligibility checked right now. Get started today at TryLifeMD.com. That's TryLifeMD.com.